Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a project of the Unpopulist. I'm Aaron Ross Powell, and this is a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical social, political, and economic freedom. We can take the social and economic concerns of the left seriously while still embracing free markets. In fact, if we understand the nature and effects of markets correctly, it can become compelling to view them not as antagonistic to those concerns, but as the most powerful solution to them available. I'm joined today by Nick Cohen. He's a senior lecturer in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Lincoln in the UK and author of the book Neoliberal Social Justice, which defends commercial society on progressive grounds. One of the frustrating things about the political landscape is that you have people who genuinely argue in favor of free markets and the power of markets to improve the state of the world. But those people tend to be very dismissive of the kinds of political and social concerns that people on the left tend to raise. And then on the other side of things, you have people on the left with these concerns who are just deeply hostile to markets and in favor of state intervention at kind of a gut level. And they're not taking seriously the concerns that many of us have about not just the benefits of markets, but the real problems that can arise from empowering the state in the kinds of ways that people on the left typically call for. What's going on there? Why do we have this odd split of kind of dismissiveness and not taking each other seriously?
Well, that's a very good question. And it kind of goes back to an observation that John Tomasi made in his book Free Market Fairness, so about a decade ago now, where he kind of noted in political philosophy especially that there were these camps that are kind of labeled high liberal and classical liberal. So, you know, obviously you might expect there to be a little bit more criticism and hostility between warring camps across the political spectrum. So, you know, among hardcore Marxists, you know, they have a respectable, but in my opinion, wrong approach to criticizing markets. And then, you know, among sort of paleoconservatives, you'll have people who might support markets incidentally because they happen to think that it helps shore up elites in some way. You know, you don't hear that expressed too often, but, you know, if you'll dig into some aspects of the conservative movement, you'll see that as well. Liberals. So the high liberals and the classical liberals, at least sort of formally, are interested in both in freedom and equality. So we think both sides think that's very important. And yet, intellectually, they seem to be very, very far apart in the sense that for a long time, there was very little discussion between these ideas. Occasionally, you would see a kind of representative figure cross over and become, the person that would be criticized. So for a long time among high liberals, Robert Nozick would have been the representative of classical liberals or libertarians in their field. And that they can kind of get their head around because they went like, okay, this is someone who's coming from a very, very different perspective. Natural rights, deontology, rights as side constraints, so therefore excluding matters of social justice, for example. And they can get their head around, well, we don't believe that, but we can understand that if you believe that, then we can understand where you're coming from. But the notion that you might share a lot of values that are much closer to what is now called high liberalism or maybe progressive liberalism, and yet still think that markets are really important and actually you need things like constitutional protections to prevent the state from interfering with markets, that is quite a difficult kind of thing to for some people to get their head around. And I think part of the answer is probably that a lot of people's experience of politics, especially morality around politics, is probably quite concrete. So if you've observed business people behaving badly, mistreating, exploiting people, you know, as happens all the time, and that's your main experience of immorality or violence or conflict, then whether that's direct experience or whether that's kind of mediated experience from, you know, what you've been reading or what you've been seeing on the television or what, family members and other members of your community have highlighted, then you're probably going to be quite critical of untrammeled markets. And you're going to get very, very suspicious when people start talking about freedom of equality and unregulated markets. It's going to look very, very strange to you. But on the other side, if your main experience of exploitation or violence would be something like the police, knocking down people's doors, taking away recreational substances, or interfering with what appear to be harmless private actions, and that's your experience and that's what you're kind of inducted into, then by contrast you'll be quite suspicious of the state, of the kind of main representatives of the state, so the enforcement arm, and especially you'll be keen to try and keep them as far as possible out of what you see as harmless private commercial transactions. So I think it's probably comes to these kind of these sort of early and quite different experiences and the way you kind of fit together the world in some way. So I think a lot of ordinary people probably have concerns about both. But once you start getting ideological, well, then you start seeing extremes. So I suppose if you've got a group of people who are kind of interested in freedom and equality, like in a kind of mix of the two, and you're trying to appeal to that group that are kind of impressionable on that front, you're going to have to do a lot to differentiate yourself from the other side, the side that's saying, "Oh, we need a bit more freedom here." And you're really going to be pushing on that front. And then in response, the other side are going to start getting more and more kind of extreme and kind of, I suppose galaxy brained in their example. So there'd be, but by the end, you kind of find out that, one side is sort of saying, well, it wouldn't be so bad if we legalized heroin tomorrow, which is not a great way of kind of reaching out to either the median voter or, the other philosophical liberal who's going like, well, that's a kind of commercial transaction where people can very easily be exploited or harmed.
It seems, too, that there's an element. So you mentioned the looking out and seeing bad market actors. And there are lots of anytime you have lots of people who are free to behave how they choose, many of them will choose to behave badly. But it seems like there's almost a fish doesn't notice the water angle to this as well, which is one of the frustrations I have with friends on the left is they don't seem to recognize how much of what they have that's really good and how much of not just what they have or what you and I have of, but people who are actually who seem to be suffering now, but are suffering far less than people in similar social strata did 100 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago. How much of that is the result of these markets? There's kind of it's not just a focusing on here are the handful of bad actors, but almost an assumption that what we have now is the default, is kind of how things normally are, the quality of life that we have now. And it's not the product of this long process of economic growth powered by markets.
I think that is very interesting. And it's sort of why I find that in almost any discipline I happen to teach criminology quite a lot of the time these days, but I find that it's the power of comparison, of looking at different environments, is very important. Sometimes when I was in the United States and I'd go to conferences, it's because the United States is so big, it's possible for people to kind of be like this, but kind of imagine the US as the default. The level of wealth and income that you see in the US and in other sort of similar Western countries is phenomenal. And if you're not seeing the way other countries are run, or experiencing sort of everyday life in those countries, obviously if you're a tourist, you're not really getting the real experience either. But if you're trying to struggle away and kind of you're working full time, trying to figure out how to afford rent and groceries and that kind of thing, these things are very important. And That's right. That only really commercial societies have made those things kind of consistently accessible to ordinary members of the public, to citizens. Systems of socialism kind of developed to some extent, but they nearly always made various key essential goods kind of inaccessible, or kind of made them conditional on having the right kind of political views, or the right being in with the right crowd. So I think actually that's the great thing about commercial society. It's not just that it produces high income and high wealth, but it does so in a way that involves, or at least has involved, perhaps up until recently, relatively anonymous trading interactions, which means that you're kind of, as an individual, you're kind of slightly anonymous and therefore a bit more autonomous. In other words, if you can make a contribution to the marketplace in some form, then you can draw on all the consumer goods, all the services that are being made in society, including public services, ultimately, without that being conditioned on your membership or your identity or, a specific identity. So it's really that kind of combination that I find very attractive about commercial society. And I find myself among left-wingers, people who care very, very deeply about making the world a better place, on regular occasions. And that's the thing I'm normally trying to press onto them, that in addition to whatever else they're trying to achieve, they should try and find a space for commercial society, because we have very good theoretical reasons, and perhaps we have even better empirical reasons, or empirical evidence suggests that the commercial society is absolutely central to the well-being of ordinary people.
I want to highlight that last mini argument you made, because I think that this one is really important. You said the anonymity of market transactions and the ability to have them not conditioned upon social standing or class membership or other categories, because for a lot of people on the left, they make an argument that is effectively, inequalities exist in markets, which is true. Domination can exist in a market society, which is true. We want to get rid of inequalities and domination. Therefore, let's move things out of the market sphere and into deliberative bodies, social councils, worker collectives, other mechanisms for decision-making and distribution. And their vision of that is that this will strip away the categories that allow for domination in the marketplace, which is basically wealth or income level, and replace it with this like flattened, non-hierarchical democracy. But what they like wildly overlook is that it will create new systems of hierarchy that are arguably much more domineering, in terms of it will privilege the people who are, if nothing else, the best speakers with the best rhetoric, or the people with the social connections, or the people who are the most attractive, or the people who are in the high status social groups. And those are things, a lot of those are things you can't dig yourself out of. If you're in the low status social group, you're in the lowest caste in India, say, there's really nothing you can do to get out of it. Whereas in a market, as you said, one can still engage in these market transactions. You may not have as access to as many options as the person who's wealthier, but you're not having like your very identity held against you in a way that seems inevitable in the systems that a lot of more far left people, it's not that they envision these other forms of domination, but I think they just don't recognize how inevitable they will be.
Yes. Yeah. And I suppose that argument is the one that comes closest to perhaps a more conservative argument in some respect, not in the sense of the kind of policies that such an argument leads, but rather in the kind of acknowledgement that seeking out hierarchy is a kind of natural feature to some extent of human societies. So any kind of level of complexity is going to create hierarchies at some point. And the question is, what kind of hierarchies do you want? Not can we get rid of them altogether? I suppose what is attractive about commercial society and hierarchies, or rather about liberal society, because, you know, yes, let's be fair, you know, like commercial societies do end up with a lot of rankings, a lot of, you know, Yelp reviews, Uber ratings and that kind of thing, you know, and of course, you know, differences in income and wealth. So there's all kinds of like metrics and things that appear to be kind of ranking people, and people might take them very seriously. But the advantage of having a large civil society is that someone can find other forms of status and esteem in the groups and associations that they find and that they can establish for themselves. So it's like that freedom of association, also freedom to form one's own kind of governance arrangements. So, you know, people might find religious institutions or sporting institutions and other kinds of things a place where they're able to kind of meet each other as equals, or if one is so incentivized, one can kind of seek a more dominant position within these things. But then once you've left that particular association for the evening, you just go back to being just another anonymous citizen. And there's something I find quite attractive about that. So it's not the lack of hierarchy, but rather lots of crisscrossing, adverse, hopefully non-correlated hierarchies. That's the best, I think, that we can kind of hope for in terms of instantiating the freedom and equality that we're committed to, rather than, as you say, a kind of flattening out, which is just a very, very unstable situation, because no sooner have you flattened everything out than people, as you say, through their use of words, through their appearance, through whatever thing that they can kind of get people's attention with, they'll attempt to establish a more dominant position in that kind of flattened situation. So yeah, no, we go for complexity and crisscrossing hierarchies so as to avoid an overarching hierarchy from emerging.
It puts me in mind of the argument in Michael Walzer's Spheres of Justice about how we can have these various spheres and inequalities of power and relationships can exist in those. But what we don't want is inequalities in one sphere to bleed into inequalities in wealth, to bleed into inequalities in politics, or so on and so forth. I want to go back to something you said earlier, just in passing. We were talking about the benefits of commercial society and how recognizing how those can benefit particularly progressive and left values. What are those values that are characteristic of the kind of egalitarian left that we're talking about?
Well, that's a good question. Let me put, I suppose it's fundamentally, you've mentioned non-domination. So they are opposed to oppression. That's sort of pretty central. Thereafter, there's sort of harm. So that's the other kind of value that they're kind of concerned about. So it's harm versus well-being and health. So it's sort of like that kind of sense of kind of physical and social security. So those are the kind of main things they're kind of going for. And I suppose what we, what we're interested in is saying, well, an advanced market society is probably the best way that you can avoid domination, both by individual businesses or firms, and also by the state. So one point I make in one paper, Basic Economic Liberties, John Rawls and Adam Smith reconciled, is that you don't want a situation where the state is the only employer. Because that's precisely the situation where, you know, if you find yourself, you know, with the wrong boss, you might find it very hard to switch. And it's also, incidentally, very hard for the state to figure out what skills and talents are required, you know, what kind of human capital to be developed, because there's no kind of market to generate it. But morally, the important thing is that you're going to find yourself in a position of domination if you have a sort of monopoly employer, whether that is formally a privately owned employer or a public employer. And so I think it's that ability to exit and to move between relationships that we're kind of looking for when we're trying to avoid, you know, that's what we think is a kind of way of avoiding oppression. That's not quite so convincing for some people on the left who would, you know, they would kind of rather see the institutions themselves kind of reformed. So we see the reform happening through competitive pressure. You force people to behave better by basically giving the people they're dealing with other outside options. And instead, there's this notion that in on the left that somehow you could, you know, if only you could just overthrow the wrong, you know, the wrong people and put the right people in place, whether it's a private firm or a bad state, then you're going to get the, you know, then everyone's going to be happy and you won't have to, you know, you won't have to exercise mobility, which might be problematic for some people. And then I think, you know, when it comes to things like harm, you know, people on the left will draw a lot of attention to is the externalities of markets. So things like pollution, which have, you know, bad impacts on people's well-being. You know, so I think, you know, a very current thing that's sort of happening at the moment is the debate about what kind of energy we should be reliant on. So should we be relying on fossil fuels, nuclear power, renewables that are kind of coming in. And when it comes to car driving, you know, are we going to be using petrol or gasoline, or moving over to electric? And it's interesting because it kind of matches up with some kind of culture, some sort of cultural conflicts, a bit of the culture wars at some of these margins and things. And on that front, I tend to think that the basic thrust of what progressives are trying to achieve is actually quite right. You know, there are a lot of externalities that that come from our current reliance on fossil fuels. It's not even just climate change. It's like it's literally the urban environment that we're in. There's a lot of social harms out there. I guess what they kind of slightly miss is the dynamic aspect of this, that these technologies themselves were at some point ways of solving other problems. So, you know, we're not born into a world where externalities don't exist and then we just introduce them. We're always already in a position where we're engaging activities that that are beneficial to the immediate parties but have some impacts on people around them. And normally, or at least hopefully, these individual actions are small enough that they don't require kind of direct intervention. But when the level of activity, say the amount of car usage, rises enough, and it's suddenly having visible effects on people's health, and also when technology changes such that it's possible to track that behavior, to track that activity, and there's new alternatives that come in, then it is time to transition. But how does that transition happen? It is going to happen, you know, substantially through things like innovation and incentives coming out through commercial society. So that's the kind of the way that I kind of try and, you know, sort of pitch our position, that, you know, as market liberals, we shouldn't be married to a particular set of institutions, set of technologies, regardless of whether they emerge thanks to the state or thanks to the market, or, as is realistically the case, always a combination of the two. But we always have a lesson about the process by which we're going to move from a, you know, relatively worse position to a relatively better position. And the other thing is that we're nearly always talking about relatively better positions, not ultimately the best position. We don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good in our kind of political economy.
How do we handle situations then where we're in a, we'll call it a bad equilibrium? So we're producing negative externalities, or the overall setup is perhaps harmful in a lot of ways, but we seem stuck in it, and where we don't have, so you said the way out of the gasoline cars is changing technology makes cleaner sources, not just cheaper, but more efficient and desirable compared to internal combustion engines. And so we naturally move in that direction, and the kind of the good stuff of environmental protection is like a bonus of it, but it needn't be the motivating factor necessarily. But as you were talking about that, one of the other areas of the economy that people gripe about a lot as having really negative externalities is social media and online communication, and that it falls under kind of the term for it is surveillance capitalism, is what it gets called. So this, where everything is about ad-driven, sucking up data about as many people as you possibly can in order to customize ads to them. But this has like huge ramifications for privacy and bad incentives for, like, you know, you want the most engaging stuff to appear in front of people because then they'll stick around. But that turns out to be the stuff that makes people angry and it's divisive and so on. And, you know, like this is the argument, but that seems to be one where there isn't like an alternative business model that seems obvious to that, because in this case, people don't want to pay for social media, which would be the alternative business model. And so it's not clear how the story that you would tell about gasoline would get us out of this thing where basically all of these people are making what from the outside look like destructive decisions, but from their own personal perspective, Facebook is free and I like free. You know, is there a story about how to solve those kinds of problems without, in this market way, that's not just saying, well, the state should step in and say ban Facebook's business model?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting and very current question. So I think I think there's a few ways of thinking about it. I mean, one part is to kind of look for comparisons with like other kind of products and services that might cause us harm. And sometimes I think about social media as almost being similar to a kind of super stimulative diet. So the high calorie foods are kind of another thing that kind of progressives think is a sort of product of the market. And normally, you know, market liberals on the one hand will go like, well, isn't it great that we've got so many calories on hand, at least? Like, this is kind of an uptown problem, just to some extent. And maybe sometimes the answer is a little bit, we can be a little bit quick to dismiss it. And when we do, it might be to say, or when we do engage with it, we go like, oh, did you know about corn subsidies? That's the reason why you've got such terrible sugar in the United States. And then we're kind of like, then we're back on track going like, oh yeah, yeah, the bad health actually caused by subsidies. And, but there is a problem that like we constitutionally, are quite, you know, are quite easy to stimulate, and thereby we kind of end up in this situation where in order to kind of taste anything, we need these super, super calorific foods and these extra additives and things that are not so healthy. And I think social media is quite similar in that it's kind of like tickles an important part of what we're up for, which is kind of, it's sort of a combination of like visual stimuli, but also social interaction. We're kind of on those platforms. It's not just because of the literal content in front of us, but because of the opportunity to share it, create some of it ourselves, and kind of try and like, you know, kind of and engage in interaction. So it's kind of, the thing about social media is it's co-produced. It's most of it is not actually produced by the companies. They're merely hosting it and they're finding an audience. So they're just playing a kind of matchmaking game there. And when we look at the kind of when we look at that from a kind of new institutional economics perspective, we realize that they're sort of providing not quite a private good. They're providing some kind of common pool good, some sort of club good that, benefits from, sort of economies of scale, from network effects. And, effectively what they're setting up is a kind of, people in sort of the antitrust world call like two-sided markets. And we know that these things can generate kind of slightly exploitative arrangements, because once you find yourself as the maven, like, you know, Facebook, then you can start to profit a great deal. And it's going to take some time for somebody else to peel away some of that business, because you want to meet everyone else who's on that platform. So unless you can persuade people to move platform, then you're not going to be able to produce the same product. So that's where the kind of exploitative arrangement, and especially the kind of, you know, sort of using data in all kinds of ways that people are not aware of, but perhaps wouldn't consent to and wouldn't appreciate if they were kind of made aware of it. So if we're kind of looking at solutions, I kind of look back to the way that the internet used to kind of work, or rather, you know, it was sort of governed by open protocols. And I think that in time, that kind of technology will catch up again. I think it's often the case that, you know, you get private firms that see kind of an open, the equivalent of an open field, and they realize that they can benefit if they kind of, you know, get in there, fence it off a bit, get the right people and get the right configuration. But in so doing, they cause, you know, they cause some social harms. But having shown how it can be profitable and how it can be beneficial, it's then possible for more superior kind of systems to emerge. So I think, you know, not just the ideal, but even the obtainable result might well be the case that we don't see social media being run forever by private firms. It'll be something more like mutual firms, some kind of arrangement where the users own the platform in some sense. We see some of this already. You know, Wikipedia is not a for-profit firm, and it's a very successful, you know, kind of information aggregator and sort of participant-based encyclopedia. If we see in the offline world, we see that there are plenty of examples of partnerships that kind of work. So they might be worker-owned partnerships or consumer-owned firms in some way. And I think once we've kind of got to the stage where we can be a little bit more imaginative, commercial society can improve the situation by having some, you know, more radical formulations of the way we do things. And I'm not on, is it Mastodon, the meant to be the replacement to Twitter, because I've heard it's quite hard to get it set up, and it's got those network effects problem. But I'm confident that either that or something else, maybe a little bit more user friendly, will come along sooner or later, and it will have the effect either of displacing or displacing. Displacing or disciplining the social media platforms that we see today. So on that front, you know, I'm not saying we're ever going to get to a situation where everyone has nothing but a lovely time on social media, because social media is a place for free discourse. And as you just said, if you give people freedom, quite a lot of people are going to behave badly. So we're not going to get like some wonderful situation where hatefulness or polarization is abolished, but we can get to a situation where it's much more likely to be ameliorated than the current environment.
You mentioned the difference between the real and the ideal and the achievable. And I want to ask about that in the context of political theory, because you talk about robust political economy, which is effectively doing political economy type thinking in the real world, with a recognition of the capabilities and limits of institutions and just ourselves to achieve the things that we might aim for. And it reminded me, my favorite footnote in political philosophy comes in Will Kimlicka's Contemporary Political Philosophy, which is very good for listeners, introduction to contemporary political philosophy. And he's talking, I think it's in the chapter about liberal egalitarianism. And I pulled it, he says, this is in a footnote 42. He says, it seems clear that liberal egalitarian theories have operated with over-optimistic assumptions about state capacity. And then he gives some examples, and he closes by saying, one looks in vain in the corpus of the major left liberal political philosophers for a discussion of the extent to which the state can or cannot fulfill the principles of justice they endorse. Which seems like a problem, right? Like, if you're going to do political philosophy, you should, if what you're arguing for is unachievable, then that's an issue, and one you ought to wrestle with. But at the same time, it seems like there can be value in saying, what is, say, like, a perfectly just society look like, even if we can't get there, because it gives us something, it gives us a direction, it gives us a metric to judge what we are doing against, and so on. So how much does the fact that the state might not be able to accomplish the things that many people on the left would task it with in an ideal world, undercut or change kind of the terms of the debate about the role of markets and other institutions in achieving these ends.
I see. Yeah. I mean, I suppose if you're kind of responding to kind of the liberal egalitarian kind of, that sort of critique of liberal egalitarianism. I mean, famously, we have Jerry Cohen, who just says political philosophy is not about action in the world at all. It's just merely specifying what we mean by words. And for Jerry Cohen, justice just is equality, you know, asterisk with a few, you know, like, you know, with some understanding about the way that actually would be actioned in some particularly ideal world. Although it's curious that actually it's clear that Jerry Cohen did think that it had some influence, or rather should have some impetus in the real world, even if he didn't think that his political philosophy could push in that direction. And you're right that you know, Rawlsians would say, well, you need an ideal to aim for, and then, you know, kind of Gauss, Gerald Gauss sort of kind of pushed back a bit and said, well, actually, there are circumstances where if you may have some ideal, you might all agree on the ideal, and you're pushing from the status quo, and you push in that direction towards the ideal, you might end up worse off. So you might actually be worse off in the position that you're in, because failing to achieve that goal puts you in a worse status than trying to achieve a more intermediate goal. So I guess that's the kind of, that was like the classical liberal case for saying we need to temper that, you know, our sense of what the ideal is. I mean, one curious thing I find about liberal egalitarianism is that actually when you kind of dig in, you don't find that much of opposition to markets as at least market mechanisms. So, I mean, that's something I found kind of quite helpful in my own work, to kind of go like, hey, look, actually, Rawls and many others realize the efficiency properties of markets and are quite happy to include them on that front. Now, they don't want to make them constitutionalized. They want to always be able to intervene. And that's where your state capacity issue comes in. Can you have a state that's powerful enough to fix every bit of a, you know, market failure or every little bit of externalities, while not at the same time empowering it in such a way that the wrong people are going to get in charge and start using it for their own ends? I actually think the much more fundamental problem for liberal egalitarians is actually likely to be the family. And this comes up a bit in the literature, that you can get some really quite absurd, well, not absurd, let's not call it absurd, let's just say that it's very radical kind of positions, basically, that you need institutions, and you need like a moral ethos, really, because they admit the institutions are not going to take you all the way. The general rules aren't going to do it. You need an ethos that really pushes against any kind of familial preference whatsoever. So in other words, concern for one's children, and investing in your children, investing in, you know, what we, you know, when we're being economistic, you know, their human capital and their social capital, you know, making sure that they are kind of thriving, you know, in among their peers, and you know, kind of going to have skills and capabilities to kind of thrive. That is such a very natural thing for many people, you know, to be concerned about their own children. Not that they don't care about other people's children, but they're always going to be very concerned about their own children. And that will be an important part of their lives, very, you know, very important and valuable aspect of their lives. And liberal egalitarians kind of want parents to kind of either stop doing that quite so much, you know, and kind of like be much more egalitarian in the way that they are concerned about the next generation. Or alternatively, they need institutions to somehow sort of compensate for all that. And I'm not sure there is, I don't think there is no state welfare. There's only a limited amount that even civil society can do to make sure that every child is loved, as well as, children in loving families are loved, basically. There is almost no replacement. And that's a tough one for for people who are aiming at, because it has all kinds of implications in, you know, for hierarchies in the future and income and wealth inequality and the way that people are going to invest their, invest their resources, because I think that's a great deal of the motivation that's going on. So for conservatives, that's just civilization. So don't even peer into it. That's just the way that it's going to work. And for liberal egalitarians, it just seems like they're kind of going very directly against just a very kind of natural impulse. And so what do classical liberals look at? I mean, I think classical liberals are kind of find the institutions around family life to be acceptable and often admirable, and are going to look again at that kind of crisscrossing civil society that tries to increase opportunities for the next generation rather than necessarily trying to provide equality of opportunity. At least that kind of substantive equality of opportunity that the liberal egalitarians are pushing towards. Because ultimately, if we were just dealing with markets, it's fine. You know, you just, you know, get to the end of people's lives and you redistribute. You know, you can do massive inheritance taxes. Doesn't really impact market mechanisms as such. But if you're doing it, if you're doing that, and you're doing it against what people actually are working really hard towards, which is to actually support their immediate family or, you know, maybe their local community, other people that they feel they have a particular affinity with, then those kind of like that sort of like expropriation of resources really bites, and people are going to try and find ways of avoiding being expropriated. And there are ways of doing it. You know, they'll focus more on the human capital of their children than collecting the material capital that they would otherwise be able to pass on. So there's lots and lots of things that kind of go wrong when you kind of go against that kind of ethos. So I think one thing that classical liberals tend to be okay with is working with those sort of natural motivations rather than against them.
Is there a concern, though, and I can imagine a left egalitarian, a progressive, listening to all of this and listening to the way that classical liberals think about these issues and saying, this sounds an awful lot like status quo bias, that I, the person on the left, I have recognized great injustices in the world and ways that the world could be, is very far from the ideal. And for out of a sense of compassion for the people I share the planet with, I want to move it a lot closer to that because they will be better off if it's a more just world. And what you, Nick, the classical liberal, are saying is if we move too fast, we'll break things. That a lot of what you want to achieve is not achievable, that a lot of some of the hierarchies or the social attitudes that seem to exist now, we probably can't change. And you can give kind of Hayekian reasons or Gaussian reasons for this. But what it sounds like to me is you're saying you should just kind of learn to accept the way things are and be satisfied with incremental changes to them rather than idealistically going out there and striving to make the world a radically better place. And that can be kind of an off-putting message to someone who is recognizing genuine and stark injustices in the world. So what do you say to people who have that kind of worry?
Well, I suppose up until relatively recently, there wasn't that much that one, you know, could say about, how to radically change the world under the kind of circumstances of commercial society. But thanks to various institutions around the effective altruist movement, there's now kind of more of an opportunity for people to put, you know, their money or their efforts towards precisely what one might imagine would be extremely important. So, you know, if you want to save many lives in very poor countries, then there are now, charities that can document, you know, with very strong evidence what they're achieving through these. Or if you want to do it in a non-paternalist way, you can, you can donate or campaign for people to donate to give directly, you know, which is just giving resources directly to the people who, on a leftist account, have suffered a great deal of exploitation. So you can compensate, you know, directly through these institutions, or support people that you think are in greatest need in these institutions. And I've actually come across a number of liberal egalitarians who are like that, they don't impoverish themselves, but for example, they will give 10% of their income because they realize, that is morally biting. That's what they do. So they're helping to transform the world in a direction that they actually want to achieve, and in a way where you have reasonable epistemic warrant that you're going to be improving the situation dramatically. And that's really actually thanks to, you know, radicals like Peter Singer, you know, a utilitarian, so kind of somewhat in between the liberal, the egalitarian liberal and the classical liberal, but, you know, kind of taking a, you know, slightly off-key approach, and said, this is a big problem for global justice, and not just keeping it in a book, but, you know, inspiring a few people and doing quite a lot of work himself to actually set up institutions that allow that particular drastic injustice to be ameliorated. So, you know, I make donations to that kind of milieu sometimes myself. I know that it's a far from a perfect kind of environment. As we discovered last year, there was a big blow up in some of the, especially among the long-termist kind of effective altruist charities, as opposed to the ones that are just giving directly to help the very poor. So I think it was kind of interesting that the problem turned up in that particular part of the movement. But all organizations can succumb to fraud and opportunism. But that's the sort of thing that one could point to and say, nope, you don't actually have to sit here passively. You can make a difference right now. One other thing that I tend to kind of notice about, at least in political philosophy or in academia, it's like, I mean, academics are very, very status seeking individuals. You know, they give up a lot of income and potentially influence and in other environments in order to have the title and have the ability to kind of hold forth with a captive audience, you know, three or four times a week, and, you know, a bit longer if you include the seminars, where the students don't think they're necessarily a captive audience after all. But that's what academics are extremely motivated to achieve. And at the same time, they seem to think that they're going to change the world this way. For any, you know, PhD students out there now, or people who might be thinking of it, that's probably not going to be right. And it's probably not why ultimately you're following the path that you're thinking of going down, or the path that you're halfway down. Ultimately, whether you believe you're doing this or not, you are highly impressionable, basically, towards your immediate social environment and whether you're getting status cues. Some people might say that is the sociology of humanity. I think there might be something a bit beyond, you know, any particular society. I think it's sort of a bit of a human universal. So in that sense, what you're doing, unless you are making costly signals to say, you know, I am dedicated to improving this situation now, I'm not just shouting about it, I'm not just looking cool while doing it, then ultimately you may have good beliefs about justice, but ultimately the reason why you're talking about them and shouting about them is because they're highly salient and attractive things to be talking about in the immediate community that you're in, whether you're in person or online. And that's okay, because we're all human, and we're going to spend an awful lot of our time making sure that, you know, we're not hungry, that we're not uncomfortable, and thereafter we're going to be looking for status in a community. If it so happens that we can hinge or put that sense of status, we kind of attach that status to doing well more broadly, to doing to doing humanity in general, treating humanity in general better, then that's good. But it always has to come down to that kind of, that sort of somewhat more self-centered motivation, because, you know, apart from the occasional saint, and even the people who get called saints, I don't count. You're nearly always going to be quite concerned about your own position in your environment when you're trying to do good. So we need to bear that in mind, and we need to have institutions that can that acknowledge that.
If I am a liberal egalitarian or progressive or person on the left who's just listened to the last 50 minutes of this conversation, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, so Nick is saying that I can hold to the values that motivate me, but that commercial society and markets are a better way to achieve at least a lot of them, or that these can move things in the right direction. What are some of the, in the policy world, what are some of the things that I am likely to be supporting now that you're saying I shouldn't be? Or what are changes that I ought to be advocating based on the arguments you're making that would advance my progressive values?
Well, I guess there's a lot that's kind of that one could point to, but I'll kind of, I suppose I'll point to the central one, because it's very, very critical in the United States and in the United Kingdom right now. You know, I wouldn't want to judge like what's going on elsewhere. You know, we need to do some comparative political economy and some careful analysis. But housing policy is incredibly important. It's got the direct issue that housing can be very expensive in areas where there are jobs, so where there are high productivity jobs where people might be able to basically increase their incomes and increase their welfare by living in better places, and the way that they're kind of excluded by things like zoning or land use planning rules in the United Kingdom, it has these knock-on effects to do with things like health and well-being. So, you know, a driving, a long commute is not good for one's health. It means that we don't get outside as much as we should do. Whereas, like, walkable cities are a great way to a much better way to live, and it means that we also massively increase our energy consumption. So the other thing that we're dealing with right now is an energy crisis and the environment. So these things are kind of all connected, and actually progressives will often agree. You know, they kind of think they do see the benefits of better city living and densification and that kind of thing under the right circumstances. And actually, I would go so far as to grant that under certain political economy arrangements, I'm in favor of public housing. You know, it can go wrong, but if it's the only way of getting new housing built, I think that's acceptable. But I think there are market ways of handling it. But what I would say is, this is a classic issue with like the difference between what outcomes and policies based on status. So what you often see in areas where there's bad housing policy is you find landlords treating tenants very badly because the tenants are kind of captive. There's no outside option. And so what you do is you see the sort of people attracted to that kind of arrangement, and also the sort of way that you end up behaving when you are given that kind of power as a landlord, you know, someone who's owned a property for 20 or 30 years since before the crisis emerged, you're going to charge higher prices. You're going to take your time fixing things. It might be that, you know, things like mold might develop. In this country, we've got this problem of kind of, nasty situations with, poor quality housing and kind of that's actually going to impede people's health, and it's not being dealt with. The policy world has this unfortunate dynamic where you think, okay, landlords are bad and evil people. We need policies that punish landlords. And what happens there is, you know, the more marginal landlord, the one who doesn't actually want to act evilly, is kind of pushed out. They think, I don't like the situation. I don't like also the status that I'm being given. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sell that house to somebody else who will be able to put up with the heat and whatnot. And at the same time, you know, very often it will make offering housing harder. So it's like, we're going to put more regulation, we're going to punish these people, you know? And so that has an unfortunate dynamic. And the slightly perverse answer is, if you've got bad landlords, what, you know, from a classical liberal perspective, is you don't want fewer landlords, you need more of them. Because then they're going to compete with each other. So the idea that actually you need to, like, you're kind of, it's like a sort of weird jujitsu move you want to do. It's like you want to penalize the current landlords. You want to make it much easier to be a landlord and get more people in and make the sector more competitive. So, you know, I can see why it might be perceived as perverse, because it means that, you know, some actually existing incumbents are not getting the punishment that they deserve. Actually they might be beneficiaries immediately of a policy that, say, was more permissive on housing. But it's better for tenants, and in the long run, it actually forces landlords to behave better. So it's one of those unfortunate kind of perverse incentive arguments. But that's the sort of dynamic that we're in at the moment, that basically the popular responses to bad housing policy is to make the housing policy worse, so long as it has a chance of hurting some of the people who are behaving morally badly at the same time. So, you know, that's what I'd focus on. So more permissive housing policy is something that an increasing number of progressives actually agree with. And, you know, we've got some specific ideas about how to achieve it. But, you know, that's what we need. That's what we need right now to make human flourishing and also, you know, ecological problems much improved.
Thank you for listening to Reimagining Liberty. If you enjoy this show, please take a moment to rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. You can also join our Discord listener community and book club by following the link in the show notes. Reimagining Liberty is a project of The Unpopulist and is produced by Landry Ayres.